Welcome to the Risk and Repeat Podcast, episode number 161. I'm Rob Wright, Security News Director at TechTarget, and I am here with Alex Kulafi, Security News Writer. Alex, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. Always glad to be here, and boy, has it been a little bit.
Yeah, it's been a few weeks. We've had a busy few weeks. We are recording this on the 13th of August, and we are going to be discussing Black Hat USA 2020, which we covered along with several other of our colleagues at TechTarget last week, and a lot of thoughts. Let's get into it. Black Hat. We, Alex, you and I, and Ariel Waldman, our colleague on the security news team, we were very much looking forward to being in Las Vegas during this time to really take in Black Hat and DEF CON in all its glory. And unfortunately, because of the COVID-19 pandemic, that did not happen. And I think it was back in May, both Black Hat and DEF CON announced that they were going to move to a fully virtual conference. And I had some concerns about how that would go, how that would work. We can get into this a little bit later, but I guess just overall impressions, how do you feel like it went for you, especially after having gone to RSA for the first time earlier this year?
Yeah, it was definitely a little bit of a whiplash, I would say. But I think Black Hat was a little more difficult for me to cover as a newer reporter to the scene than RSA was, because RSA, sure, there were some technical sessions and there was some stuff to learn, and there was some groundwork I needed to do to make sure I got all my facts right and whatnot. But there were people to talk to there. Mm-hmm. I mean, you were on hand, which was nice, but like more importantly, there were attendees there who I could talk to gain like ground level insight into a deeper level into what's going on. And here I didn't really have that. And as it turns out, as we'll discuss later, the two sessions that I ended up covering mainly were ones where I really would have benefited, I think, from talking to attendees there or to the speakers. But as far as the digital event's concerned, I'd say it was well put together. I mean, barring some technical issues.
Yeah, I thought overall, and again, we can circle back to this in a little bit. I thought, because there were some things here and there that definitely could have maybe worked a little better. But I thought it came off really well. And especially Black Hat, I thought they did a good job of putting together a decent lineup of sessions and speakers who did an excellent job sort of pre-recording their talks and then being online afterwards, whether it was actually online, like live via video, some of the speakers were, or just chatting in the community sort of chat on the video pages for each sessions. And I thought that worked out pretty well. But like you said, some of the stuff, like you covered the two sessions, and this is my fault. maybe we should have swapped. But you probably learned a lot.
I did.
Ripple 20 and the Stuxnet session about the printer vulnerability were two pretty technical sessions. And you, like you said, you go to RSA, it's not just the attendees in the room of the actual session and sort of the Q&A, the live Q&A that you can get there that's beneficial. But even like when we're in the press room talking to our colleagues at other outlets that we know or that maybe we don't know, and we just met talking to analysts that we've maybe never spoken with face-to-face before, and just getting their input on stuff, like it's pretty valuable. It is. And when you go to a virtual event, when you attend a virtual event, you lose some of that. But that said, let's get into the sessions, because there was definitely some there was a lot to digest from this year's show. And let's start with the Ripple 20. So you covered this session. This was research that was, I guess it was first unveiled back in April, I think, sort of teased, and the preliminary report was released on this collection of 19, I guess, vulnerabilities in various manufacturers, IoT devices that were sort of tied to this specific library. What did you learn about Ripple 20, which probably
so was a lot. I can actually say a very similar thing about Ripple 20 that I can about Stuxnet, is that the world is not rid of talking about Ripple 20, nor is it rid of talking about Stuxnet. Yeah. They're still here in some small way. And Ripple 20, I would say, in a bigger way. Months after those vulnerabilities, the 19 were reported, not only have things not gotten better, but the experts who were talking at Black Hat 2020 were saying that we may never fully be rid of these vulnerabilities getting exploited or these vulnerabilities being present.
Yeah, it's a sobering thought. I encourage people to check out that session from the researchers at JSOF, the cybersecurity. I guess are they a consultancy? Not really a vendor, I guess. But they're based in Jerusalem. They found these vulnerabilities in these IoT devices and manufacturers, and they were all sort of tied to that one. It was a TCP/IP stack from a specific vendor, right?
Yep, it was called Trek. Just to quote the article, widely used among a long list of connected and IoT devices from vendors such as Intel, Cisco, and Hewlett-Packard Enterprise.
Yeah, and I think what you learn from something like that is, you know, just how far, I mean, the name, Ripple 20, there's a reason for that name. They said basically there's a ripple effect from this one library that has just sort of, you know, one company used it and then another and then another, and it just sort of spread through however many years. What was it? I think they said close to two decades. And that got into all these different manufacturers and different devices, and some without them. It seems like some didn't even really know that they were vulnerable to these vulnerabilities because they didn't know that they had this library in their software.
Right.
It's just incredible. Yeah. It's like, it's a small piece of the overall software for these devices, but I think you probably saw why, I guess, IoT devices, there's so much concern about IoT devices, connected devices, these quote unquote dumb devices that are all connected to the internet, connected to networks, connected to enterprise networks in a lot of cases. And how, you know, these DVRs and stuff could be used for, denial of service attacks and stuff like that. But it's like you could use these things to get into corporate networks. They talked about ICS devices, right? I think at one point, if memory serves. Yeah, so not good. Not good. And I think, what was your takeaway, I guess, on what we're looking at for the future? Obviously, you know, they said we may never be rid of this vulnerability completely ever, or these vulnerabilities, I should say. But, like, are they expecting to find even more devices and vendors down the road? Does it seem like they're optimistic that they've got all the ones that they think are affected by these vulnerabilities?
It sounds like it's an ongoing process. For sure. And I think the super messy thing here is that when you're talking about IoT, you're oftentimes not talking about something isolated to medical devices or routers or DVRs or industrial control systems, but you're talking about all of these things being affected at the same time. which makes it way more difficult, I would imagine, to sort of treat the problem.
Yeah, I know that, I think they talked about at one point just the difficulty in figuring out how to patch so many different types of devices, so many different manufacturers. You don't know what type of systems some of those smaller vendors, especially manufacturers, have in terms of being able to deliver security updates. And even if some of those companies are still in business, you know, maybe they're not. It's crazy. Before we turn to your other session, Stuxnet, as you mentioned, I'll chat a little bit about the election security theme at this year's show. It's a big theme. There were two keynotes this year, one from Matt Blaze, and he has been he's been on the election security, election infrastructure train in terms of, you know, his concern level and what he thinks needs to be done. And he spoke before Congress earlier this year and testified about, you know, what he thinks needs to be done with the U.S. election infrastructure sort of to protect against hacking. And he sort of updated a lot of what he said at that time based on new information, not the least of which is the COVID-19 pandemic. But I thought it was interesting. One of the things that he talked about was he sort of indicated that we were going in the wrong direction in terms of the new technology that we were bringing to market. He said that basically paperless voting technology, whether it's, you know, mobile or just your typical electronic voting system that does not produce a paper receipt or use a paper ballot, it's dangerous. He talked about sort of these complex blockchain solutions that are being introduced to ensure the integrity of the vote are just sort of, he had some harsh words for blockchain. So definitely concerning, although he said he wasn't completely pessimistic. He actually had a little bit of optimism, which was nice. He thinks that, you know, there's a lot of expertise in the InfoSec and computer science community, and that there's a lot of researchers who can help with these problems. He encouraged everybody in the audience that was listening and that, you know, maybe listening down the road to engage their local election officials, state election officials, offer their support, even offer to be a poll worker or assists your locality with IT support. You know, he feels like, you know, hey, we got the expertise, but we can do this, but we need to engage like immediately now. You know, we're now what, 90 days less before the election. So I thought that was interesting. And then there were other sessions. There's Chris Krebs' session on election security, and he talked about the threat of ransomware, which I think has been really, really underestimated. Ariel covered that one, had a good story on it. There was also the session about the vendor, ES&S, basically coming to the show for the first time and saying, we've got a vulnerability disclosure program, and we want to engage with the security research community, and we want to better our products. And it was a pretty bold reversal, about face, change in direction, I guess, from that industry, or at least from that vendor. But the overall industry, as you know, Alex, I mean, you've written about some cases here with Votes, the mobile voting vendor. Mm-hmm. How would you characterize the relationship between the security community and the and the voting technology vendors?
Contentious.
Yeah, contentious is probably putting it mildly.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the election security topic, the issues around it was a big focus 4 years ago, and even after the 2016 election. And it was a big focus once again. And I think we're so far pretty lucky, I think. You know, there's obviously a number of reports about attempted threats or looming threats and attempted attacks, but no, we haven't seen anything like the DNC hack or you know, a major campaign chair getting phished and having these leaks and you know, potential data, you know, voter registration database hacks. Like it's been relatively quiet. I don't know if that's going to continue. I guess we could debate whether that's going to continue or not. I'm nervous, but so far it seems to be a slightly better situation than it was 4 years ago. Speaking of situations that are not better than they were 4 years ago or maybe longer, Alex, your Stuxnet session, not yours, you didn't deliver it, but you covered it. What did you learn there?
So at my Stuxnet session, SafeReach researchers, SafeReach Labs, excuse me, they discovered new zero-day vulnerabilities connected to Stuxnet, which is, one might say, the most legendary malware to ever exist, if legendary is a term we will use connected to malware.
Yeah, you can. I don't think you can quite overstate with superlatives its influence and its status. I think even people in the general public know about it. I mean, it was the subject of a documentary, which I highly recommend people check out. Zero Day, it's something else. But, legendary.
Yeah, and then Stuxnet. I mean, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably know what Stuxnet is. And yes, you probably found out maybe when I was 17 years old what Stuxnet is. but it used a printer spooler flaw, along with other zero days, to spread through Iran's nuclear facilities. And the scary thing about this malware is that it physically damaged uranium enrichment centrifuges.
Yeah.
And like whenever you hear of like computer problems causing real life damage,
that's always
a little scary, Rob.
Yeah.
So Microsoft patched the spooler flaw in 2010. But SafeBreach Labs discovered that Microsoft did not actually fully fix the bug, and two researchers, the two who presented at Black Hat, Hadar and Barr, discovered new vulnerabilities stemming from said print spooler flaw. And I believe it was 2 0 days that came from this.
Mm-hmm. One was a privilege elevation one vulnerability. And basically this, you know, like, they were very careful, because I watched this session too, because there's no way I was going to be able to edit your story without watching it. I was interested in it. I really was. I mean, this was one of the more high profile sessions, I think, for Black Hat. And we should note both the Stuxnet session from SafeReach and the Ripple 20 from JSOF. Both of those sessions were also featured at DEF CON. They recorded two different sessions, but it was the same presentation, basically. So that gives you an idea of how sort of important and interesting the content was there. But basically, they said, you know, hey, if you take these new zero days and you use this bypass from, you know, the old patch for this printer spooler vulnerability, you could have malware that propagates with the same sort of power and sophistication as a Stuxnet 2.0, which, you know, they're not saying it's going to, like, you can just spin up malware and exploit these vulnerabilities and you can start blowing stuff up. No, because you know, there's a whole ICS component to Stuxnet that was different than the initial zero days that helped compromise the initial sort of network infrastructure of Iran's nuclear facilities. But you could create a ransomware, a ransomware worm that could use these propagation capabilities exploiting those zero days. And that's not good. That is not good. And they were, if memory serves, I think they said they were the patches. One had already been patched, and one was going to be patched in the upcoming patch Tuesday. And they were very careful about releasing the details for that very reason. They don't want to just like be willy-nilly about here's how you exploit this and then have someone create Stuxnet 2.0.
Yeah. And then the other vulnerability was a DOS condition.
That's right. You know. Yeah. Denial of service. That was a trip down memory lane. that was something that was, like you said, it's an infamous, it really is an infamous just sort of malware that looms very large. It's you know, the code from Stuxnet is out there. It's been reused and pieces of it have been incorporated in other types of threats over the years. And it's just, you know, I think people get concerned every time they, or anytime they see, you know, the word Stuxnet and it's, and the potential for, you know, new threats there. So yeah, not great. And then I should note the second keynote for day two of Black Hat. I covered that, and it touched on election security as well. It was a little different though. It was about disinformation campaigns and how they propagate through social media. It was delivered by Renee Diresta of the Stanford Internet Observatory. She talked about, you know, a lot of the stuff that we already know, nation state hackers, APTs using social media, troll accounts, spreading disinformation, propaganda, fake news sites, all the stuff that we've sort of become accustomed to since, you know, the 2016 election. But one of the things that I thought was interesting that I focused on for our coverage was in her session, which was called Hacking Public Opinion, she also talked about how these disinformation campaigns, these disinformation attacks can be sort of, are weaponized against companies, against enterprises for different reasons. But it's basically like these hackers, these threat actors will get together, they'll create these reputational attacks, these smears of enterprises, public companies, private enterprises, et cetera, either because of, you know, the nation state is trying to get a competitive advantage against a multinational company, a U.S. company that's maybe competing overseas, or maybe there's bigger sort of geopolitical policies involved. And I thought that was really interesting. And there was actually she mentioned there was a congressional report about how Russian nation state actors were using, you know, an extensive number of troll accounts and sort of fake identities throughout social media to launch a reputational attack against several U.S. energy companies over, you know, sort of accusing them of like fracking malfeasance and so on and so forth to sort of disparage them. And, you know, there's all sorts of motives involved there, murky geopolitical stuff, but it was really interesting. And I think that's something that maybe a lot of enterprises don't always maybe understand or anticipate. And she talked about how, you know, CISOs need to, especially in today's politically charged environment where social media is just hyper-analyzed, the need to sort of be careful with what you're putting out in social media and the conversations that you're having on social media with your brand, because it may not be what you, it may not be what it appears. There could be threat actors involved. There could be troll accounts. And she suggested that the CISO take, you know, a closer look at that activity and maybe even start to do some red teaming around it, which I thought was really interesting, because it's not the sort of thing that you think of like a pen test firm or a red team to do, you know, engage, like make dummy accounts on social media and start spreading fake news or smears, or, you know, start arguing about, you know, pick your political topic, Black Lives Matter or whatever. So I thought that was interesting. That was something different that I hadn't heard before. So I think all in all, it was a pretty fascinating lineup of sessions that we got to cover. So
yeah.
Alex, let me ask you something. Do you think this model can work going forward? I mean, we mentioned, you know, there were some hiccups here and there, and, you know, I know some people had some login issues with trying to get online, and there was some reception issues for certain people, and, you know, there was chatter about this on social media, and you know, same with DEF CON. I think DEF CON had some hiccups here and there. People were complaining about the Discord chat going down, and but I think all in all, like it went off maybe better, especially with DEF CON, which sort of got pulled together a little later than Black Hat. But do you think like that this type of thing can work?
I think it's already proven that it has worked, despite the little problems. Maybe not super little, but I would say minor problems relative to the problems that could have happened.
Yeah.
I'd say that as a first attempt, or if we're gonna call the last few months a first attempt at this kind of thing, I think it went off pretty well. And I'm going to make a prediction, Rob.
Go.
I may have made this prediction on a previous episode, but I'm if I did, I'm stronger in my prediction now than I was before.
Yes, go.
RSA is going to be digital.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not a news. That's don't take that as news reporting. That's just my guess. But yeah. Like, just based on like the way things are happening in COVID world right now, I don't think we're going to San Francisco next year.
Yeah.
I mean, if there's a San Francisco to go to, we'll go. Like, if there's a show to go to, maybe we'll go. We'll see. But I don't think RSA is going to go on as a physical event next year.
Right. It still amazes me, looking back at everything that has happened, that we went there and not only did we not get sick, but you know, still at last count, I think there were only 3 confirmed cases of attendees who, and the contact tracing that they did, RSA to their credit, was pretty good, and the way they informed people after the fact that you know they had 2 and then I think later 3 confirmed cases, one of which, you know, the gentleman was in the hospital, and I believe he recovered, thankfully. It's just kind of amazing, but I think you're right. And here's the interesting thing, not to go too far off on a tangent about this, but I wonder, like, I felt like this worked really well, all things considered.
Mm-hmm.
And this gave people who might not normally go to Black Hat, might not normally go to DEF CON, that might not be able to make it there, that might feel like it's too wonky and too technical and too it's too sort of high level for them. This gives people the opportunity to check out some of these sessions and to learn and to get exposed to some really good content and some really good speakers and to find out more about, you know, maybe something that's in their wheelhouse, maybe something it's not, they're not exposed to, they're just interested. Maybe they want to learn more about Stuxnet. I think that's really good. I think that is great for the industry. I think it's great for the InfoSec community to get this stuff out there. I think it's great for people to get it for free. I think it's great for up-and-comers, people that are maybe moving from like a compliance position or a legal position or just a network admin position, to be able to take advantage of this content and use it to up their knowledge and better themselves. But I wonder long term, like, how sustainable this is, because I mean, this was free. They didn't make any money off. I don't want to say they didn't make any money, but compared to like doing a physical event, they didn't make any money off this. Neither organization. They're not charities. They're businesses. And as good as this is for the InfoSec community to do it this way, and how easy it is for people to take it. I mean, DEF CON had these sessions up before, like before the sessions were even quote unquote like live. Mm-hmm. Like they're tweeting out links. You can watch it on Twitch. You can get on Discord. It's great. It's fantastic that this stuff is so pervasive and everybody can take advantage of it. The problem is, again, these are businesses. And I just wonder, like, you know, there's no reason you can't do this in addition to a live event. There's no reason you can't have a regular virtual event that has maybe more themed content or, you know, specific content to a particular area or a particular type of technology. and just it, I think it, it would benefit the entire community and the industry. But again, it costs money to do this. I mean, these guys had to pull this together in a couple months and they were successful, but I just wonder, like, man, if it gets to be August next year and we don't have a good handle on this, I mean, it's asking these guys in both companies, both organizations, both conference organizers, it's asking a lot. And that concerns me a little. As much as I'd like to have this content be out there for free and have people take advantage of it and the benefits of that, that's, you know, that's a whole nother question, so to speak. So, but yeah, I mean, I'm going to, like, me personally, I'm going to go in and I'm going to check out some of the sessions that I didn't get a chance because I was busy writing my own stuff, covering my own sessions, helping you guys with yours. I checked out a couple of the DEF CON sessions. There was a really good one on the Red Team Village about a Zoom vulnerability and just the whole process in discovering it. And I really good content. And I'm going to go back and, like, I think we're all going to go back and check out some stuff that we didn't get a chance to watch in real time. But it is, like I said, as good as that stuff is, it's like, man, if they can't get live events, like, I think RSA is going to be fine. They're owned by a big company. Black Hat, you know, they're owned by a large media organization as well. I don't think this is, you know, if they do a virtual event again, it's a no-go. I think they can do it, but it's a lot to ask for essentially what we're getting, which is free content. That's obviously hugely beneficial, but it's free. So there you have it.
Yeah.
But you're right. I think we're looking at almost certainly a virtual RSA. And we have a bunch of events coming up in September and I think October and even November as well that are going to be virtual that, you know, I mean, we might not have checked out, but as a live event, we might have not had the budget late in the year to get to that we'll be able to go to and cover and maybe have some content of our own.
Yeah.
But it'll be interesting, like you said, to see what happens next year. Fingers crossed. I don't know.
Fingers crossed for what?
I know. Like, do I really want to go to RSA? Okay, fair point.
Okay, I'm just kidding. But yeah.
No offense to RSA. RSA was a grind. And you had the specter of, like, oh, am I going to get sick? These people wearing masks and coughing and feels like a different lifetime. We'll have more events to cover for the search security team, for the TechTarget security team. Hopefully they go as well as Black Hat did. We shall see. Alex, thank you for taking the time to chat with me about your inaugural Black Hat experience, and thank you for the content you provided.
Thank you, Rob.
And thank you to the readers and listeners of Search Security. I'm Rob Wright, and we will see you next time.